Welcome, everyone, to the Undisclosed Addendum. We've got three sponsors this week. They include our new sweetest sponsor, Sherry's Berries, our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron, and the sponsor that gives me the cleanest face that lets me run this place, Harry's. Listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to this week's Undisclosed Addendum, where we talk about all things undisclosed. In this week's episode of Undisclosed, the Alabama Highway Part 2, we delve deeper into the investigation and prosecution of Heath Wilson for a highway shooting that occurred in the same night and about 10 miles away from the shooting of Isaac Dawkins. This is Colin Miller, and I'm joined this week by two very special guests. First, we have Kay Levine, a professor of law at Emory Law School. She teaches and writes in the fields of criminal law and procedure and has a particular interest in prosecutor decision-making. Before becoming a law professor, she worked as a staff attorney for a federal judge in Honolulu and practiced criminal law in California as both a prosecutor and a defense attorney. Kay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
And next we have Rick Latta. Rick is an attorney in Georgia, currently the undisclosed fellow with the Georgia Innocence Project. He started working on Joey's case at the beginning of January of 2014 and returned to continue working in the case this September. Rick has also been accepted into the PhD program in the Law School of Edinburgh University in Scotland. He loves the law and wants to perform more justly. So, Rick, welcome as well to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everybody.
Now, Rick, I'll start with you. You graduated, as I said, from Georgia State in 2012, and it wasn't long thereafter, in January 2014, that you started working at the Georgia Innocence Project as a volunteer attorney, and it was back then that you started working on the case of Joey Watkins. And so what do you recall about getting the case and working on it back in 2014?
So I started in January of 2014, as you said. I had recently been admitted to the bar here in Georgia, and I just got in touch with the then executive director, Amy Maxwell. I sent an email and said, "Hi, my name's Rick. Is there anything I can do to help?" And she said, "Come down." So I came down. I spent the first day helping with letters where people were requesting help. And then the second day, she handed me two boxes of papers that turned out to be Joey's case. And my understanding is that initially, Bill O'Dell, the sort of co-ish attorney in Joey's case, but the lead attorney for the co-defendant, Mark Free, he brought the case and was trying to find someone to help. And the Georgia Innocence Project had accepted the papers, but it was about this time that I joined. And so I just started working the case. At first, that really meant just going through and sort of unshuffling these boxes of papers that included trial transcripts and notes that had been collected from various groups, and cataloging, figuring out what we had, trying to learn the case because I had no idea about it, and then going on from there. Eventually, it meant traveling to Rome a lot, interviewing different people, and beginning to start trying to put together an understanding of the case, but then what could be next steps.
Yeah, and Kay, on the other hand, after you graduated from Berkeley and worked in Hawaii, you then went to work as a deputy district attorney in Riverside, California for about 3 years. And so what was it that led you to become a prosecutor, and how did you find that experience?
So I was one of those people that did not like law school at all, which I'm very open about with the law students. I just really didn't like it and found most of the conversations not particularly interesting. The only things that I found interesting were classes like criminal law and criminal procedure. So that first year summer job, that Riverside office was hiring, and I thought, you know what, well, I'll give it a shot because this actually seems kind of interesting, and went for the half of the summer and thought, very good people, interesting work, but I don't see myself going back there. Midway through my clerkship in Honolulu, I was thinking, what do I feel like doing? And that seemed like the most interesting job. So I went, I think mostly because my commitment was to victims. Not so much commitment to police issues, but commitment to victims. So that was an office that had a very strong victim witness bureau, still does have a very strong victim witness bureau. And so that was appealing to me. My time there was hectic, and I remain like in awe of some of the people who are the lawyers in that office and their commitment to what they do. But for me, it was clear after just a few years that I wasn't cut out to be an advocate assigned to one side, that I had more questions about the sort of work that we were doing and whether we were really making a difference in the lives of so many of the people who are coming before us, either as victims or as defendants. So I would say, you know, looking back on it, my experience as a prosecutor gave me a research agenda for a lifetime and the ability, I think, to ask the right questions about whether the justice system is really doing the right thing, not just some of the time or most of the time, but in the vast majority of cases.
Yeah, and then to your point, after that, when you worked as the deputy district attorney for about 5.5 years, you were an attorney and criminal defense consultant. So how did you find operating, I guess, somewhat on the other side of the issue?
Right. So that was when I was in graduate school getting my PhD, and my husband had a practice that included criminal defense, so I was practicing with him. It was less challenging than I thought it was going to be to make the switch from prosecution to defense. I think, you know what, prosecutors so rarely get a chance to see or interact with the defendants as people, and so I didn't really have much experience doing that. That was really eye-opening, I think, getting a chance to see the defendants as full-bodied people with wives and families who care about them and reasons for doing what they do. And also, most of the people that we represented really wanted our help, not because they were aggressively asserting their innocence, but they wanted somebody to help explain the system and help make their experience with the system bearable so that they could come through the other side and continue to live a life. And so performing that role, that suited me actually pretty well. And I felt like, having had time as a prosecutor, although not in the same county, I had a pretty good feel for how the system was going to work that a lot of the defendants really could appreciate, because, you know, they sort of wanted somebody who had that kind of inside view of why cases were being handled the way they were being handled and why something would go to trial or why a plea offer might be what it was going to be. So even though my prosecution experiences in Southern California and the defense experience was in the Bay Area counties, I felt like there was kind of a nice synergy. And now I can bring both of those experiences together in the classroom for my law students.
Yeah, and Rick, in terms of working on both sides of the process, last year, for about half a year, you were in Cambodia and doing an internship at the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia. And so can you tell our listeners a bit about the work of the ECCC and what you were doing there in that internship?
Yeah, absolutely. So the ECCC is a hybrid court. It's been set up sort of half Cambodian, half United Nations. And its purpose is to try people in connection with crimes committed during the Khmer Rouge. So there was a government in the mid to late 70s called the Khmer Rouge. And these are essentially often known as genocide trials. It includes genocide as one of the claims that's being brought, but it includes other claims like crimes against humanity, various war crimes. And so I got a chance to work with the trial chamber, which was in, so I was working with the judges. And the judges doing the actual trial, there was a Supreme Court chamber, there was sort of the appellate chamber, and then you had prosecution and you had defense, but I was with the judges. And I found it fascinating. It was eye-opening to see how that law all works. I love it. It's interesting law. I think there's a lot. There are many ways in which the rule of law can be a real help, and I try to keep my hand in studying it and paying attention to how it's developing. And it's also just good. I agree. I haven't had as much opportunity yet to see all the different sides of the law, but it's helpful. And it's good to understand that, to see sort of the humanity in all of the different sides, prosecution and defense. And I was honest in the beginning when I said that I do love the law. I think it has an important role to play. I want to see it operate more justly, as I think we all do. But no, I love prosecutors, love defense as well.
So I have a short but tragic tale to share with our undisclosed listeners. Last week, I very excitedly received a box from one of our newest sponsors, Sherry's Berries. And I opened up this box. It was the first time I had gotten Sherry's Berries, and 12 luscious, chocolatey-looking strawberries looked back at me. They were covered in nuts and chocolate chips and swirls. And I was so excited, especially because my husband was out of town. So that meant those were all going to be for me. I ate two of them and I put the rest in the back of the fridge. Well, he came home the next day, and 24 hours later, when I went back to that box, they were almost all gone. And I did confront him. I said, "Did you eat all the Sherry's Berries?" And he said, "Well, no, I mean, I had a couple, well, maybe three. Okay, I don't know, four." The point is, I think he had a lot more than that, and I didn't really want to share that box, but this holiday season, believe me, Sherry's Berries is an incredible, unique gift that is perfect for sharing even when you don't want to. No matter who you're shopping for, Shari's Berry is the one-stop shop for everybody on your list, and you don't have to battle the crowds to get this perfect gift. In case you forgot, Christmas is only 10 days away. That's 10 days you have left to shop, wrap, and deliver your gifts. But if you choose a gift from Shari's Berry's incredible collection of gifts, you can go ahead and skip those crowds and the hassle altogether. You can shop with convenience right from your home. So here's a great offer for undisclosed listeners. You can get freshly dipped strawberries from Shari's Berry's starting at just $19.99. That's over 30% savings. Or you can double the berries for just $10 more. All you need is our undisclosed code to take advantage of this deal. It's US2. Here's what you're going to do. Visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in US2 to get this special discount for our listeners. Shari's Berries has something for everybody and every taste. And they're not just berries. They have amazing seasonal treats just in time for the holidays. You get to choose your delivery day, and Shari's Berries will deliver your gift fresh and on time guaranteed. And you know what? You might want to order a box for yourself. Enjoy and happy holidays.
I wanted to go to a Twitter question. This one comes from Kat on Twitter, and she asks, why are law enforcement / lawyers / prosecutors so afraid of criticism / investigation / transparency if they're so right? And Kay, I specifically wanted to direct this to you because you co-authored a piece called The Cure for Young Prosecutor Syndrome, and that was based off of interviews with over 200 state prosecutors. And one of the conclusions there in the piece was, quote, while young prosecutors begin their careers thinking of themselves as superheroes, ready to try any case in the docket and to do battle with any defense attorney who stands in the way of a conviction, more seasoned prosecutors think of themselves as arbitrators, negotiators, BS meters, and advocates. They have traded in their capes and swords for a more diverse toolkit that allows them to calibrate their responses based on context and resources. So you mentioned before how your work sort of had this lifelong research agenda. So can you tell me a bit about this article and more generally your scholarship on prosecutors?
Yeah, okay. So I've been studying prosecutors from this sort of academic perspective really for well over a decade, probably 15 years at this point. My dissertation research was about prosecutors who handle statutory rape cases in California. And then this project that I've been doing with Ron Wright, where the Cure article is one of the publications that's come out of it, it all involve interviews with prosecutors asking them, not really like why they do what they do, but to kind of reflect on how they think about themselves, how they think about their jobs. And I take from what they tell me, I'm able to kind of see these larger patterns. And so the conclusion that we draw in the Cure for Young Prosecutor Syndrome piece, based on interviews with hundreds of prosecutors in 8 different offices in different regions of the United States, was this dominant theme that came through as prosecutors reflect back on their younger selves at how gung-ho and guns blazing they were at the time and how they lacked judgment. And they were sort of all about prosecution and persecution for the sake of it without really having any sense of proportionality or pragmatism or the cost of what they were doing, the literal cost in terms of dollars, let alone the human cost in what they were doing, their sort of blind faith in victims and blind faith in law enforcement. And the story we heard over and over and over again was how all of that shifts over the course of a prosecutor's career. So, and I need to say, like, we definitely heard stories of people we call zealots who did not make the shift, who stayed that guns blazing, all prosecution all the time approach throughout their entire careers. We absolutely heard stories about people who prosecute that way, and stories about those kinds of zealots dominate in quite a lot of what's been written about prosecutors generally. And there are definitely certain offices that seem to promote that kind of zealot mentality, and other offices that promote what we think of as a balanced proportionality mentality. So I think the sorts of cases that end up subject to the kind of inquiry that Undisclosed is doing now in the Joey Watkins case, you know, sort of the post-conviction setting, is an unusual way to get a window into prosecution overall. I think that the post-conviction setting has some stressors on it that the standard day-to-day work of the prosecutor does not necessarily have in most offices, where they're handling lots and lots of cases in many places with this more sort of pragmatic proportional mentality. So the post-conviction setting, I mean, it definitely has some stressors. And I do think that there's a tendency to circle the wagons and to be very resistant to criticism. But our work on prosecution has really tried to illuminate more of the day-to-day functioning of how state prosecutors are working, handling the hundreds of more kind of run-of-the-mill cases that they see every day.
And one of those arguments in the piece, when you're talking about the difference between young versus older prosecutors, the one constant, it seems, is that the young prosecutors do hold judges in high regard. And in both of the seasons of the podcast, we've talked about potential Brady violations where the prosecution fails to turn over material exculpatory evidence. And I noted, Kay, that one of the articles that was building off of your piece was called The Brady Colloquy by Jason Krieg. And in the article, he says that judges should engage in what he calls a Brady colloquy with prosecutors, where the judge in the courtroom is asking the prosecutor, have you turned all over the evidence, and essentially asks a series of five questions. And I wonder, what do you think about that proposal? Do you think that that makes sense, or do you have any other ideas about ways to curb the Brady violations that are out there?
I actually think that makes a good deal of sense. You know, sometimes just making something explicit and making somebody put something on the record might cause a different approach to the behavior. And it sends a different message about what is expected if prosecutors know that judges are going to be paying much closer attention. Miriam Baer, who's on the faculty at Brooklyn, has another article that I think it's called Timing Brady, where she makes a sort of similar suggestion about raising Brady disclosure obligations much closer to the surface so that it isn't just something happening between offices or between the prosecutor and the defense attorney, but having the court be much more involved in the disclosure process. So I do actually think that makes a good deal of sense. And for, again, in the course of these interviews, people say what they say. And of course, there's some measure of impression management anytime you're interviewing somebody about who they are as a professional. But we heard, you know, hundreds of times from all these people we talked to that they don't play close to the edge. Nobody they know plays close to the edge. Their boss would never tolerate it. And yet there are so many stories of prosecutors who not only play close to the edge, but have gone so far over that they have subjected people to wrongful conviction. So I think, you know, trying to figure out what are best practices from those offices where people just know that if you even have a question about it, you turn it over and there's no second guessing. There's no playing the materiality game or hoping that you're not going to get caught later. I think figuring out what practices are happening in those offices, what sort of messaging they're getting from their leadership, not just the elected and the chief administrators, but the well-respected attorneys in those offices, and figuring out how those kinds of messages can be shared with the other offices that unfortunately have a very bad reputation for continuing to have Brady violation problems. So this came up in New Orleans, for example, under the administration of Harry Connick. The office was sued. The case went up to the Supreme Court, and the theory was the office failed to properly train its prosecutors on Brady disclosure obligations. And what the Supreme Court decided was that was not the basis on which a defendant could recover any money. The individual prosecutor and the office would be immune from any suit for damages, for money liability. And that kind of immunity, you know, there are people who could defend it. Me personally, I don't think that's the right call. But the result is that in New Orleans, even after this Connick versus Thompson case came down, continues to have problems. And some of those were documented by Ellen Yaroshevsky, who is a clinical law professor at a different law school in New York. So I think that sort of the office culture and the messaging from the top, as well as more explicit involvement by judges, I really think could go a long way.
Yeah, and while the Connick case is certainly a case that, as you say, immunizes the prosecutor, there's the other case we've discussed, which is Collins versus Whitley, which says that basically the police are an extension of the prosecution, and if the police fail to disclose evidence, that's a Brady violation as well. And Rick, our next question is from AR on Twitter, and he asks, so he said he was on Highway 27 and Sutton told no one. Does Sutton have a feud with the Watkins family? Why focus on Joey? And just to contextualize this again, this is, we know Heath Wilson was on Highway 20 and maybe had involvement with that shooting, and the shooting of Isaac Dawkins is Highway 27, and through all these years, it's always been the claim that Heath Wilson was not on Highway 27 on the night in question, and as we reported on Undisclosed, the notes of Sutton seem to say that Heath Wilson indicated he was on Highway 27 on the night that Isaac Dawkins was shot, and so we mentioned before, you worked in this case in 2014, and now you're back in 2016. What was your thought process when you heard that, in fact, Heath Wilson had apparently told Sutton he was on Highway 27 on the night of the Isaac Dawkins shooting?
I was surprised, but not terribly surprised, because Heath Wilson has always seemed very interesting to me. as another possible suspect. So evidence suggesting that he was on the right highway on the night, in a sense, sort of fit with some of my suspicions. But I found it very interesting. I found that interesting, and I also found interesting what Claire was saying about looking back into the 911 dispatch cards, that one of them may have been corrected, that the 911 caller said that they were on 27, the right highway, passing the Kawasaki dealership, and the Kawasaki dealership is on 20. And so there was some discussion, and the road was changed because they just assumed the 911 caller meant 20, not 27.
The other thing about this, about the Heath story, that I just found stunning, but it's consistent with the Sutton not turning over the statement about his admission to be on Highway 27, is that the officers put together this binder of photographs of all the bluish-green imported little sedans in the whole Floyd County area, right? They went around taking photographs of cars.
Yeah, they drove around
small parking lots and this, whatever. And the one photo they don't show to the eyewitness is the photo of Heath's car.
Right.
That is completely unexplainable. Consistent with the story of, you know, the why they didn't turn over the statement either.
Yeah, and that ties into the next question that I had, Rick, which is that I saw the GIP tweeted a few days ago that undisclosed pod fellow Rick Latta giving a talk about Timberlake versus State, just because you're innocent doesn't mean you get out of prison. And that involves somewhat a similar issue in terms of not disclosing a photograph and the consequences in the post-conviction context. So can you tell us a bit about that Timberlake case? It was a 1980 case out of the Georgia Supreme Court, and what the court held there?
Yeah, so the Timberlake case was important because it lays out the six prongs that are needed in order to request a new trial based on new evidence. And the talk that I was giving was about another one of our clients here at GIP. His name is Baradia. There was physical evidence in the case. It wasn't tested. We finally got it tested for DNA and came back excluding Baradia and implicating the alternate suspect. But he's still in prison. And he's still in prison because Georgia said this second prong of diligence, Baradia should have tried harder to have the evidence tested at the trial. And because he didn't, he's going to stay in prison. But now that you've asked, I'm blanking for a second on Timberlake.
Well, the Timberlake case, it was a murder case where the defendant, Timberlake, had allegedly killed the victim at a Texaco station. And on appeal, the defendant claimed various Brady violations and grounds for a new trial. And one of them was, going back to the point that Kay made about not showing a picture of Heath Wilson's car, was that the prosecution hadn't turned over this photograph of an alternate suspect in the case, and that was George Parton. And despite that, for some of the same reasons you noted in the case that the GIP is handling now, the court found even if there's evidence of innocence or a Brady violation, that based upon lack of due diligence, couldn't be granted a new trial.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, and we're running into this. We run into this now a lot, unfortunately. And so that's the subject of my talk, whether this is what we want to be doing sort of as a people, if we want to be leaving people that we know to be innocent in prison in the interest of finality, or however you want to phrase it.
Yeah, and if we look at this, you know, obviously this has been a fight for both Adnan and Joey, both of the defendants we've talked about in both seasons of the podcast. And if Adnan's order for a new trial is upheld, and or if Joey is given a new trial, then one of the possibilities that's been floated in both cases is an Alford plea. And Kay, in looking through some of the media coverage of the West Memphis 3 case, I saw a few quotes by you about the Alford plea. And so if you could remind our listeners of what the Alford plea is, and I guess share what your current thinking is on an Alford plea in these types of cases.
Sure, yeah. The typical guilty plea involves a defendant, first and foremost, admitting his or her guilt to the crime. And in a dialogue with the judge asks a series of questions to make sure the defendant knows what he or she is doing, is willing to do it this way, admits guilt, and then provides some, we call it, factual basis that allows the judge to feel confident that this defendant actually did what he or she is admitting to having done. And only if a plea meets this knowing involuntary test is the judge supposed to say it's acceptable under due process for us to enter a conviction instead of having your case go to trial. A case called Alford versus North Carolina asked the U.S. Supreme Court to decide, well, if a defendant says, I want to plead guilty, but I'm not going to admit that I actually did it. Would it still be acceptable under due process for a judge to accept the plea as a form of conviction? And what the Supreme Court said was, you know, yes, it would be. It would be fine. Defendants are allowed to make a strategic choice that on the advice of counsel or to get out of custody or to get a shorter amount of custody, to take advantage of whatever bargain the prosecutor is asking for. If a defendant wants to do that and still insists that he or she is innocent, then the court ought not to stand in the way. The Supreme Court did make a point of saying, though, that individual judges or individual jurisdictions could say, you know, for our purposes, we don't like this kind of Alford plea. If a defendant wants to take the deal, the defendant has to admit guilt. You can't get the benefit unless you also take responsibility. So there are individual judges and there are some jurisdictions, counties or cities or states, that have decided as a matter of law, they're simply not going to let a defendant do that. The taking of an Alford plea, some people think of it as a no contest plea, the way you would do in a traffic case. But basically, you're saying, on the advice of my attorney and in order to limit the consequences of going forward, I'm going to plead guilty even though I still insist that I'm innocent. So the taking of an Alford plea has come up just really a handful of times in these incredibly serious cases, and the West Memphis 3 is one of them, where this series of defendants had been convicted. Evidence was brought forth that maybe the conviction was completely inappropriate. They would get a new trial, but they still face the consequences of staying in custody through that new trial, and there was some uncertainty about what might happen. And so the prosecution offered them the ability to take an Alford plea, meaning say you did it and we'll give you credit for time served and then you can be done. It also came up in a case from Texas. The defendant is Kerry Max Cook, who was one of the founders of the play called The Exonerated that was traveling the United States several years ago. Kerry Max Cook was prosecuted for the rape and murder of a young woman in a West Texas town. He was prosecuted 3 or 4 times, convicted, sent to death row, his conviction was overturned. Mistrial, convicted again, it was sort of back and forth and back and forth. By the time it got to the 4th or 5th trial, after the appellate courts in Texas had told the prosecution that the amount of misconduct in the case was appalling and they would no longer be allowed to use the testimony of their main witness who had since died, the prosecution decided rather than try Kerry Max Cook yet again, they would offer him the ability to do an Alford plea. And after consulting with his very experienced attorney, he decided to do it. And the way he tells the story, he regrets it every day. He wishes that he had fought for his innocence because he still is in the system as a convicted murderer because he took the plea. Admitting that is taking the deal, a conviction is entered on the record, even though he's innocent. And in the case of Kerry Max Cook, shortly after he took the Alford plea, DNA evidence established that he was not the killer. And yet there's nothing that can be done about it because his plea was, in fact, knowing and voluntary under the due process clause.
Yeah, and Kay, that's, as you know, a reason why a defendant like Cook or the West Memphis 3 might take an Alford plea is because there is risk on retrial. And our next question comes from a Redditor named Harush and notes, on the other hand, if Adnan or Joey decides I'm not going to take a plea deal after getting a new trial, and there's a new trial in the case of Joey Watkins, at least, he could be given the death penalty in Georgia. And that links in with an interesting development in Georgia, which is overall nationally, administration of the death penalty is down significantly. But in Georgia, it's up. They have 9 executions this year, which is the highest in the country. And that's almost double the highest previous total in Georgia of 5, which was in 1987. And then again last year. So for both of you, I wonder, living there in Georgia, what do you think explains this increase in executions taking place in Georgia in the last couple of years?
I have a suspicion. My suspicion is that it's incoming. I think we have taken a sort of more death penalty happy stance for a number of years now, and it's finally coming to fruition, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my sense is that, you know, the executions that have happened and that are scheduled to happen are from cases that are extraordinarily old. They're 2 decades, sometimes 3 decades old. I actually don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to explain why Georgia would be an outlier compared to some of the other states that have stemmed the tide. Some, you know, have kind of taken a different path. I don't actually know. But there is something in Joey's case, you mentioning that if he were to be retried, he could face the death penalty. Do you know, in the first case, it initially started as a death penalty case. Were those the initial charges filed against him and then the state backed off, or the jury voted for life?
I'm going to have to go back and look, but I don't remember that being the case. I think they did not convict on malice murder, right?
Right.
But I am not remembering them seeking the death penalty.
Yeah, I don't think they did. The only thing we mentioned this season was the Montana case where Susan had talked where they had the death penalty on the table and then the prosecutor made this show on the first day of trial of sort of taking that off. And I guess, yeah, with Kay, with you being on and all the work you've done with prosecutors, I'm not sure if you listened to that episode, but it was a case in Montana, and this is similar to what Barry Scheck writes in his famous work of this prosecutor there on the first day of trial, and it's a capital case, and they make a big show in front of the judge and the jury of saying, well, I'm going to take the death penalty off the table, so you're no longer holding the defendant's life in your hands. What do you think about that tactic that some prosecutors employ?
Wow. I mean, I think it is appalling, actually. I mean, it is such a sort of public display of, look, we can be merciful here. And so it's a way to gain the trust of the public, but in such a public way that strikes me as very unprofessional. Like if you, me and like lots of other people who think about prosecution ethics believe that capital charges should never be filed purely for leverage or as a political tactic ever, that is such a violation of the prosecutor's obligation as a minister of justice. So if this prosecutor's office wanted to pursue this as a capital case and believed that it had the evidence to pursue this as a capital case, that's what it should do. And if it doesn't think it should be a capital case, then they should take the capital filing off the table. But to do it in front of the jury is so manipulative that it can only be as a way to sort of garner trust for the prosecution side of the story. So that really strikes me as unprofessional. But the reason that I was asking about whether capital charges were originally filed against Joey is that we have jurisprudence from the Supreme Court that says after a successful appeal, the prosecution is not allowed to up the charges against the defendant. To do so amounts to a presumption of vindictiveness.
Yeah, that would be Blackledge versus Perry is the key Supreme Court case. Yeah.
Right. So suddenly if Floyd County wants to turn this into a capital case when it never was a capital case before, I would think that the defense has a very strong argument for the presumption of vindictiveness, that nothing, in fact, has changed in the 15 years since the crime was committed that would make this suddenly a capital eligible murder when it never was eligible before.
That's a good point. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Here's the way it works. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, and recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs. And there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Plus, Blue Apron has a freshness guarantee that promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. So if, like many people, you're really busy during the holiday season or you know someone who's going to be really busy, what better time to try Blue Apron or give it as a gift? So, Undisclosed listeners, you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/up. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/up. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And sort of on the other side of Georgia law, mentioned obviously the uptick in the administration of capital punishment in Georgia. On the other hand, I saw an article, and this is just bizarre to me, this sort of in the backdrop we have of all these police shooting cases, and the article noted that Georgia used to be the only state in the country that allowed police officers who faced possible indictment to sit in on the grand jury proceedings and hear all the evidence before making a closing statement without facing cross-examination. And then I saw, Kay, that you were cited in the piece on this. Empirically, it said there were 184 deadly Georgia police shootings. Not a single police officer had been prosecuted. And now Georgia did get rid of this. But as you say, there's still a lot of work to be done in Georgia, right?
That's exactly right. Georgia, I think, was the only state that had such police-friendly provisions for officer-involved shootings at the grand jury stage. And there was a lot of legislative activity on this issue last year. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution did a number of stories about this and documented that there had been, I think 184 shootings and not a single indictment of a police officer. And that helped fuel the legislative fire. But prosecutors and police officers did not support all of the reforms that were suggested. And the one that is still currently, I think, very much under debate is whether there should be an independent prosecutor every time there is an officer-involved shooting. That is, there's too much allegiance and affection between a prosecutor's office and the police agencies that service the county, that the prosecutor cannot be objective. Or at the very least, even if the prosecutor believes she could be objective, the appearance of favoritism is so strong that the grand jury's outcome will always be questionable. So, but when this was all being debated last year at the legislature, prosecutors and police, to my understanding, they would not sign on to that provision to staff an office of independent counsel through the state AG's office, or I'm not really sure what the institutional arrangement was going to be, but they wouldn't sign on to that. They would agree that, okay, so the officer is no longer going to be allowed to make a closing statement not subject to cross-examination. That they agreed, okay, that goes too far. But the independent counsel provision, they wouldn't agree to.
And then, Rick, my next question, this comes from Sally Doherty, and I guess sort of there's the specific question of Heath Wilson and the broader question is someone who's worked on this at two different points in your life, the Joy Watkins case. Sally asks, wait, what? Heath got home just before 8 p.m., all shook up, and got his mom to ring 911. Reason undetermined. Why would Heath get his mom to ring 911 about an incident he was the aggressor of? Maybe Heath shot at Isaac not intending to harm, but saw him crash and then got his mom to call 911 about the accident. And so my question to you is, I mean, you've worked on this case, as I said, two different periods. What do you think overall about the viability of Heath as an alternate suspect? And then big picture, do you have any grand theories about this case and what might have happened?
So first on Heath, there are a couple of things that make him interesting for me. The first thing that stood out is that there were eyewitnesses to both incidents. This was the first thing that stood out to me. There's an eyewitness in Isaac Dawkins' shooting. There's eyewitness accounts of this other incident on 20 involving definitely Heath and his girlfriend, Tracy Dunn. And when I read the two eyewitnesses' accounts, sort of put them side by side, this is my take, but my sense was you could almost take any paragraph from either account and interchange them without breaking the story. I mean, the two accounts to me read like they were talking about the same incident almost. And in numerous different ways, right? In both cases, the person being chased sped up and the person following sped up and kept up with them. Then they slowed down and the person slowed down rather than going around. Then they like pulled out of the lane to let the person go around. And instead, the person slowed down and pulled into the other lane behind them. On and on, the similarities were striking. So I think he's very interesting as an ultimate suspect. The issue with Heath Wilson as an alternate suspect, as you have mentioned in the podcast, is the timing. The timing is tight. But the timing's tight in every different direction involving everyone with this. And that's just going to be the case. There was a shooting while cars were traveling down the road. And after the shooting, this is Isaac Dawkins. The car that was pursuing him, that appeared to have been where the shot emanated from, sped off down the road. It all happened quickly. It was all in motion. And we know that the attacker fled quickly. So you would expect the timing to be tight. So for me, I think Heath Wilson is the person that I keep coming back to. It's not the only sort of interesting other lead. As you've discussed on the podcast, there were shots fired at cars from a field around this time. There were incidents of other people being shot while driving down the road. And there was a tantalizing, and it was still just a little piece of information by the time I left in 2014, about a similar incident in neighboring Bartow County. So there were lots of different other possible leads, but I think Heath is the one that seems to keep coming back. And then your second question about the case, I've forgotten it now.
Your overall perspective on the case in terms of Joey as a person, I guess, in terms of the behavior of defense counsel, the prosecutors and police.
Yeah, so it's interesting. When I first got the case, I was, I believe, the first attorney with the Georgia Innocence Project to look at the case. And so it was starting from the ground up, and it took a while to sort of get involved in the case. The case has a lot of, first of all, first impression, and I think this may be everybody's first impression, is that it's enormous and completely unwieldy. And there's very little physical evidence. There's tons of witnesses, tons of testimony, and there's a lot of sort of gossipy nature to it. And so it's hard to get one's head around and arms around. I think Joey's an amazing person, and I'm absolutely convinced of his innocence. And as the end of your last podcast mentioned, coming up is going to be some discussion of the cell phone tower, cell phone evidence. And I think listeners will find that fascinating. It made the basis of the first habeas petition for Joey. And so that helped me. That and other evidence helped me get an understanding of the case and get an understanding of Joey's innocence. And then also just working through the different pieces. On its surface, you know, I was turned off by the dogs. You know, when you have somebody implicated in killing dogs, you know, my initial instinct is sort of to recoil. But as with that evidence and the rest, each step, as I would look into a piece of evidence that seemed very damning against Joey, it would fall apart. Mm. And mentioning the dogs, about the police and the prosecutor. As I said earlier, I love the law. It's the thing that I feel like my hope in life is that this is the area where I might be able to help. Like, I think it's not the only source of good, but it's one possible one. And so I'm all in. And I like defense attorneys. There is definitely a place for prosecution. It's important. We don't want to live in a society where women can be brutally mistreated, you know, where people can commit murder. And prosecutors help stand against that. But we have to be careful how that work is done. And in this case, there will be some things coming up, especially about the dogs, to foreshadow, if that's okay, where I think what I consider to be serious legal, potentially, but definitely moral violations were committed. And that stuff has to come to light. And I think we have to think Joey's case and all of these cases give us an opportunity to think about specific incidents and to think sort of globally, like this talk, the Chaka-Chaka thing I did. You know, we want to think as a people, what do we want to do when we find out someone's innocent and they're in prison? Do we want to be the sort of people that will say, yes, you've proven your innocence, but we just feel like you took too long in doing it, so we're going to leave you in prison? That's sort of a global thing. And then we also have individual issues about how individuals are acting within the system. And this is a good case to look at that. It's an odd, and maybe every defense attorney feels this way, but it's been a long battle to try to get the information that ought not to have been that hard to get, like going to Rome so often and digging. I think it was sort of mentioned, part of my job recently has been digging through just every single piece of evidence inventory log. So far, I've made it from December of 99 through the end of 2003. And not just our case, but every single piece that exists at the Floyd County Police Department. And it's because they accidentally destroyed their chain of custody evidence when they ported from one database to another. So then how do you deal with that? I mean, you're in a crunch time. You've got the legal side, you know, there's a lot of case law study that goes in. You have to do a lot of different things. And then also, do you have time to sit there and try to figure out what to do about getting a hold of what evidence still exists in these just sort of manila folders that sometimes relate to the date that's stamped on them and sometimes don't? I don't know. There's a lot. And so it's taught me a lot about the system. It's an important system. It's not as we conceive it on law and order, but it's an important work. And so I think, you know, all in, it's good.
Yeah, and Kay, Rick talked there about the specific and the global. And so I wonder, first, your specific take on this season of Undisclosed and Joey's case. And then second, the more global is one of the other pieces you wrote is about looking at prosecutors in three dimensions as opposed to two dimensions. And one of the big criticisms of Serial Making a Murder, even our podcast, is the lack of the prosecutorial voice. And I wonder what your take is on, I mean, obviously there are reasons why the prosecutors won't take part about that sort of missing from what's being presented to the public.
Right. So I have listened to most of the podcasts from the season. To me, the evidence is very striking. I'm following along. Rick saying, you know, every time they looked at something, it seemed to fall apart. That was the impression I got listening to the podcast. And I'm listening with a skeptical ear because I think, you know, from my training, I try not to second guess other people's cases. And I'm asking questions along the way of, well, did you talk to that person? And did you do this? And you guys seem to have done it. You followed all the leads that would naturally occur to me. the amount of gossip among these late stage adolescents talking about who's driving around when and what they're hanging out in the Home Depot parking lot. And there is nothing consistent. So I don't know. And the fact that Tammy Coulson has never spoken to you, I can understand why she's never spoken to you, but boy, I sure would like to hear from her about what she was thinking and what she was doing. It's my understanding she's now a judge. Is that right?
Yes, she's a judge.
Yeah. So I think that's troubling. And somebody in this last episode mentioned that Stanley Sutton is now in a nursing home. And so it's unfair that you're not talking to him or whatever. It doesn't strike me that it's unfair. It's unfortunate, right, that he won't come on and sort of actively explain why he did what he did. So there seem to be very big problems in this case. Making a Murderer, I watched the series on Netflix. I have rarely seen a case with more reasonable doubt than that one. The kind of police work, the commonality between these two cases is the police work leaves a lot to be desired from the perspective of a citizen who wants the police to do a good job to catch the people who actually did the thing. They give me no confidence based on the police work that you guys have uncovered and the Netflix producers uncovered. And I understand that Netflix say it's a documentary. They have a point of view, but without the prosecutors stepping in to say, you know, the things that were left out of the story or the things that were left on the cutting room floor are A, B, and C. And that's why the case was so strong. We don't hear those things. From the people I know who are still actively involved in prosecution, they say, well, when a case is actively being appealed, it's inappropriate for the prosecution to talk. I think that's true. And yet, if there are actual things in their trial record that the prosecution would point to as this was the solid evidence of guilt, this is what we built our case around, and the Netflix filmmakers or the undisclosed producers left that stuff on the cutting room floor, I think the public ought to know about that because we are interested in getting the full story of justice. No member of the public is interested in seeing somebody who's actually a murderer walk free, but we want to see the full story of justice. But I think prosecutors, individual prosecutors, may be in a tough spot because they work for somebody else. That was not the case for Tammy Coulson. It's my understanding she was the elected prosecutor in Floyd County. So she would be speaking for herself and her own decisions. She's not subject to the bureaucracy of her office. Other individual prosecutors along the way, they may not have such liberty to speak if the person who they work for doesn't want them to speak. But it does leave the public with a lot of questions about how exactly is law enforcement operating. There are lots of tools at their disposal, not nearly as many as are shown on shows like CSI and NCIS, where so much of the technology is invented for TV, but there are a lot of tools at their disposal. And so when you hear about lapses and sloppiness and the hiding of statements or the incomplete taking of witness statements, it's hard to feel confident that the officers did all they could do to make sure they got the right person. In this case, I think if they hadn't arrested Joey, and I'm still not entirely sure how they settled on him so quickly, that is not clear to me. But Heath is the obvious suspect, the one in the area driving a car that matches the eyewitness description, engaging in the exact same behavior on the night in question. He's the obvious suspect, so that he was dismissed so quickly suggests to me there was a reason they wanted to dismiss him so quickly. And again, that doesn't give me a whole lot of confidence that police were pursuing this in any kind of objective and professional way.
Scientific fact, guys are impossible to shop for. That's just the way nature made us. Me, personally, I like the things I need, not the things I want. And what I need is to have a clean shaven face, or else I look like a hobo. That's where Harry's comes in. Here's why. Great razor, reasonable price, delivered to you in a beautiful box that is ready to gift for that special someone in your life this holiday season. So check it out. If you haven't heard of Harry's before, it was started by two best friends, Jeff and Andy, who were fed up with being overcharged for razors. They started their own razor company to give people what they deserve, a great shave at a fair price. This holiday, Harry's is delivering on Jeff and Andy's mission by providing for you ready-to-gift shave sets at all different price points, starting at just $15. They all come with a razor handle of your choice, shaving cream, replacement blades, and a travel cover. In fact, that Winter Winston set that I told you about last week includes an engravable chrome handle if you want to add that personalized touch. As a special offer for fans of the show, we've partnered with Harry's to give you $5 off your order. All you got to do is enter the code UNDISCLOSED at checkout. But you got to do it quick because ground shipping for the holiday ends on December 16th, so act now. Go to harrys.com to get a holiday shave set and don't forget to enter our promo code UNDISCLOSED at checkout for $5 off. That's harrys.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED.
Yeah, and the last question I have is, you were just talking, obviously, in the back and forth about all this true crime media, and of course, for understandable reasons, the focus of these podcasts and documentaries is on wrongful convictions, but the interesting thing that I see in your CV is the last 4 years or so, you've been working on a grant, and this deals with what I would call sort of disparate enforcement, and it's another huge part of the criminal justice crisis we have that's very much separate from the wrongful conviction issue, and this is an NSF grant you're working on, and what you're working on is called Race, Place, and Discretion in the Handling of Drug-Free Zone Charges. So could you share with our listeners a bit about that project and the scope of it?
Yeah, sure. So my co-authors are three criminologists, Elizabeth Griffiths, who's on the faculty at Rutgers, and Vulcan Topali and Josh Hinkle, who are on the faculty at Georgia State. And our grant was initially about investigating the pursuit of drug-free school zone charges in a diverse region like Fulton County, Georgia, where Atlanta is the major city, but then there are other suburban regions. And our intuition on the drug-free school zone charge is that it gets policed very differently in dense urban regions than it does in suburban and rural regions, because the school zone is defined by a radius as the crow flies, 1,000 feet from the outer boundary of the school. If you are caught possessing with intent to sell or selling drugs or narcotics within 1,000 feet of the outer boundary of the school or park or playground or public housing unit, then that subjects you to a significantly enhanced penalty. Here in Georgia, for the first offense, it could be up to 20 years for the first offense, up to 40 years for the second offense. So our intuition was that, well, in the dense urban core, like an inner city, everywhere is within 1,000 feet of a school or park or playground or public housing development. Absolutely everywhere. You can't spit without being close to one of those things. So that means that every drug sale that takes place in the inner city is going to be subjected to that heightened penalty. And what we know from decades of criminology studies is that people sell drugs basically within their neighborhood. They are not driving like 20 miles away. So it's the people who live in the inner city or selling in the inner city who would be subject to these heightened penalties. And people who sell in the suburbs or rural regions where things are much more spread out, we don't have this dense population core, there's a lot more flexibility. So that was our intuition, and that's what NSF funded us to research. What we found is that that's not actually the case, that we found surprisingly few of these drug-free zone charges that are being filed by the Fulton County DA's office. So our investigation has since turned to trying to explain why that might be, because the leadership of the Fulton DA's office is not shy about filing crimes when there are facts that support them. So we have spent the last several years not just trying to identify the patterns in drug enforcement generally, but to try to come up with some explanations for why, given the opportunity to file this zone charge left and right, they simply don't seem to be doing it.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting. I look forward to seeing the results of that. Rick and Kay, do you have any additional thoughts about the Joy Watkins case for Undisclosed or any questions for me?
Well, one was, and you sort of alluded to it, there was one of the questions that was included in sort of the primer for this thing today was from a listener. They were asking about why Heath's mom might have called. And I've thought it was interesting. I think we have thought it was interesting. Officer Boyd with the Floyd County Police Department said that he got an earful from Heath's mom about arresting or suspecting Heath of anything. So this was sort of a suspicion on my part, is she might have called, and it may have been possibly that she knew people in the Floyd County Police Department. And so she was calling to get a chance to speak with someone. So that's sort of my suspicion. Hmm. But then also, I wanted to give a quick shout out. There was a mention in this most recent podcast about some evidence that was discovered in 2014. There was the gunshot residue test that had been performed on the victim, Isaac Dawkins, and its discovery. And although I was there, technically, it wasn't me. It was actually an intern, super great guy named Paul Martin. And he had gone with me. And it was the first time that I had gone to Rome to speak to a, they were the first police department, the first sort of people that I went. We just went to try to look at their evidence or their records and make copies. And we had these big three-ring binders that they gave us, and Paul was going through one of them, and he's like, "What's this?" And he pulled out a very large envelope that said evidence all over it, but it had never been checked in. It was Paul Martin, who's awesome.
Gotcha.
Do you know if they were able to test it after all these years, or it had so eroded?
I have no idea. It wasn't actually even closed. So it was discovered in the three-ring binder of notes that I believe belonged to Moser, who was the lead investigator in the case. And the officer that I was there with, who wasn't Moser, sort of dumped out in his hands some of the contents. And you could see it's like little plastic vials that had Q-tips mm-hmm. sort of inside them. The Q-tips were obviously discolored because it had been 14 years. But I don't know if they ran tests. I mean, I don't know how informative it would be anyway, because I don't know if it's just sort of a perfunctory thing that they do or why they did it. But there was no gun found in Isaac's car. I don't know if there's a reason to think that Isaac was shooting at all. So that's a long answer. Short answer, I don't know, but mm-hmm. I don't think so.
And Colin, I have one for you. Do you know where this case stands in terms of post-conviction at this point? Like, has a habeas been filed already on the basis of what you all have found?
We are on the brink of something being filed, and hopefully for both Joey's sake and the podcast's sake to a lesser extent, in the next month or two, there will be a filing. And so certainly listeners should look for that coming soon. There will be something that will be coming out, legally speaking, in Joey's case.
Okay. So all of the various pieces, whether it's the 911 box of records disappeared, or the thing about the gear shift in neutral, the story that was made up about the car got pushed onto the roadway. I can't remember whose story that was. Somebody came to Beckstein? Like, oh, the car, they actually got out of the car. Beckstein, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, got out of the car, pushed into the roadway, like that whole thing.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
All of these things are mounting together in support of one large claim on actual innocence. I mean, I would assume, you know, his trial defense attorneys did some of this. My sense is that they were not nearly as effective as they could have been, mm-hmm. even with the information they had at the time. I mean, again, like, I try not to second guess what people do, you know, as right. an outsider, but it seems like there were quite a few avenues that they could have pursued and didn't. I don't know. Is that your sense too?
Yeah. Actual innocence is very difficult to prove. And luckily, I believe we found ways with the evidence and some of the law in Georgia that the filing in this case will not have to establish actual innocence to be able to get him a new trial. So I think we have ways to get around that. Yeah, procedurally speaking and substantively speaking, I think that there is a way around that. Yeah.
Got it.
And it was based on other evidence, but the first habeas petition before we got involved did include a claim of actual innocence.
Right. And it also involved the cell tower evidence, which is the next episode. So as you mentioned, Rick, we very much look forward to presenting a second round of ping to the listeners with regard to the cell tower evidence.
Good. Well, I think you guys are doing a dynamite job. I'm glued.
Well, great. Yeah, thanks so much for listening. And thanks so much to our guests today. So Rick and Kay, again, thank you very much for taking part and listening to the podcast and for your great questions and answers. And take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a reminder, fans can discuss each episode of Undisclosed with the hashtag Undisclosed or hashtag Justice for Joey. You can tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UDAddendum. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod. And you can follow our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at GA Innocence. I'd like to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production. I'd like to thank Patrick Cortez, who composed the new addenda theme. And as always, I'd like to thank Mital Talhan as our producer.